Welcome, everyone. This is the second session in the mini-series on ontology rules and logic programming for reasoning and applications. Today is Thursday, October 31st, 2013. This session, the title is The Concepts and Foundations of Rules and Ontologies, Logic Programs, Classical Logic, and Semantic Web, Part 1. Harold Bowley is my co-chair on this. So you'll go to slide 2. A lot of this is recapitulation from last week, basically the topics that we want to cover in this series. I won't go through this. It's mainly for new people who could not attend last week. You see that we wanted to cover a large spectrum of material. Slide 3. Again, our goals, which are restated, and these are on the website. We want to really sketch out the current field of ontology and rule reasoning, provide a perspective on emerging technologies for ontology and rule reasoning, discuss the issues and architectures involved in developing applications that use these, and describe visualization explanation technologies for these technologies. Slide 4. We currently have 5 sessions planned in this mini-series. Today is the second one, which is highlighted in blue. And prospectively more to come after the Ontology Summit, which takes place typically the first 3 months of the year, so in 2014, January through approximately March, April. And finally, slide 5, today's agenda. We're focusing on logic programming, especially, and semantic web extensions, but you can consider these topics of wider interest. So today's panelists will be first, Harold Bowley, who will be talking about from data to knowledge through gray log visualization, then followed by Benjamin Grossoff, a high log, defeasibility and the foundations of practical meta-knowledge, brief introduction, and George Gottlob, data log plus minus, a unifying framework for ontological reasoning query answering. We're going to have to be pretty strict on time to make sure that we have enough time for every speaker and also time for discussion. So I would approximate 25 minutes per talk. We'll try to provide you some warning before you exceed your time. So at this point, I'd like to move to Harold Bowley. Dr. Bowley, if you'd like to continue with your presentation.
Thank you so much, Leo. The slide numbers should be on the lower right corner of each slide. So we skip from the title slide 1 to slide 4. It's about visualization of data and knowledge. Graphs remove the entry barrier to logic. So we want to proceed from 1D symbolic logic knowledge specification to 2D graph logic visualization in a systematic syntax. That supports the human in the loop across the whole spectrum of knowledge elicitation, specification, validation, and reasoning. And this is combinable with graph transformation for indexing and parallel processing to get efficient implementations of specifications, and it also moves towards model theoretic semantics. In particular, we allow unique names as graph nodes mapped directly injectively to elements of semantic interpretation. Slide 5. Graylog, the graph-inscribed logic, provides intuition for logic. An advanced, cognitively motivated systematic graph standard for visual logic, data, and knowledge. Because the features are orthogonal, it is easy to learn and can be used, e.g., for business analytics. So we have a generalized class framework as one uniform 2D syntax for major semantic web logics. And you can pick a subset for each targeted knowledge base mapped to and from RuleML sublanguage and exchange and validate it, pausing queries again in Greylog. Slide 6. Generalized graphs to represent and map logic languages according to Greylog 1.0 systematics. We have used generalized graphs for representing various logic languages, where basically graph nodes represent individuals, classes, and so on, and graph arcs represent relationships. In the next slides, I will discuss what are the principles of this representation and what graph generalizations are required. Later slides will then go into how are these graphs mapped invertibly to logic, thus specifying Greylog as a kind of GUI for knowledge. And maybe there will be time for having more in-depth look into systematics of Greylog features. Slide 7. First, the Greylog principles. Graphs should make it easier for humans to read and write logic constructs via 2D state-of-the-art representation with shorthand and normal forms, from controlled English to logic. Graphs should be natural extensions, e.g. N-ary, of directed label graphs, DLGs, often used to represent simple semantic nets, i.e. logically there are atomic ground formulas in function-free dyadic predicate logic, and especially binary data log ground facts, RDF triples, Facebook Open Graph, and Google's Knowledge Graph are all special cases of these DLGs. Graphs should allow stepwise refinement for all logic constructs, including description logic, constructors, frame logic frames, generalized PSOA RuleML terms, and so on. These extensions to boxes and links should be orthogonal. Slide 8. Now, in particular, these Greylog generalizations to DLGs. Directed hypergraphs can be used for N-ary relationships where directed relation labeled binary arcs will be generalized to directed relation labeled N-ary hyperarcs, e.g. representing relational database tuples or Prolog predicates. Recursive hierarchical graphs for nested terms and formulas, model logics, and modularization, flat graphs will be generalized to allow other graphs as complex nodes to any level of depth. And label node graphs for allowing high-order logics describing both instances and relations or predicates, arc labels will also become usable as nodes. So slide 9. I will now go into graphical elements, starting with names, and first we look into unique names. Written into boxes, so I can give us a unique name specification. And written onto boxes, so I can give us non-unique name specification. And Greylog combines both. Slide 10. I will now start to map from the left-hand side graph version to the right-hand side symbolic logic version, starting with instances, individual constants with unique name specification, like Warren Buffett is the constant name Warren Buffett, and so on. Slide 11, you will see here non-unique names, like WB is an acronym for Warren Buffett. It's written onto set, and you could have multiple others on written on these boxes as node labels. In the symbolic version, we use vertical bar to indicate non-uniqueness. Slide 12, graphical elements hatching patterns, now hatching for constants, hatching for variables. 13, we'll now look into individual variables. We have this hatching pattern for variables X, Y, and so on. 14, now let's start with the DLGs binary relations. So we have an example in the lower part of slides. I often show examples. And in the upper part, the general case, inst1 connected to inst2 with a binary relation in logic written as prefix bin rel applied to inst1, inst2. But in graphs and semantic networks, were written as labels on these arcs. And here's an example with Warren Buffett, Trust, General Electric. 15, that's a non-crowned version with variables of a binary relation, 16. Now, let's look at the graphical element of arrows. Labeled arrows for arcs and hyperarcs are now being used where hyperarcs cut through nodes intermediate between first and last. 17. So now you see an hyperarc between instances 1 through n is labeled rel. In a logic, rel would be a prefix. We have here the example of n equals 3. WB invest into GE 3 billion. 18, we have an implicit conjunction when you draw multiple hyperarcs into the plane. They are meant to be conjunctive. In logic, that's made explicit. This is conjunction infix. Slide 19, you can also make it explicit in Greylock graphs by moving on to complex nodes. So we have now a box around these two hyperarcs for investments of Warren Buffett and JS, and that corresponds to extra parentheses around the conjunction in symbolic logic, and it's needed when you embed such a conjunction into other connectives like disjunctions, and you need this bracketing corresponding to complex nodes in the visual form. Slide 20. Here we have disjunction wavy line, so to speak, indicating some undecidedness of which of the hyperarcs is claimed to be true, maybe one or more. 21. Now let's look into normalization of intercrossing hyperarcs. So we have one labeled Shaw pointing from John through Latin to Kate. Another label, Teach, pointing from Mary through Latin to Paul, and we have this crossing here. Notice in the right column I show a DLG, which does not specify to whom Latin is shown or taught. So the controlled English of said knowledge presentation is shown at the bottom, 22. We can move the crossing outside the Latin notes, and it's more typical even in DLGs, you can have such crossings. 23, we can also disentangle the two, and we no longer need that crossing in this particular example. And 24, so here is a correct binary reduction of a directed hyperarc system into a corresponding DLG graph, where you need to introduce 8 arcs with 4 reified relationship nodes that point to the argument. So for the Shaw hyperarc, we introduce a Shaw 1 instance of the general relation Shaw, where arc 1 through arc 3 point to the 3 arguments. Likewise for Teach. 25. Here's a version which is on the left-hand side, copying the Latin node into 2 nodes, both being unique names. So the reading of those graphs is that if it's a unique name, then it can be merged again. In the symbolic version on the right-hand side, you have to use copies. Slide 26. So now we move on to label node graphs, where the relation normally written onto an arc is moved to the very first node, so it becomes a label node. 27. The special case of hyperarcs of length 1 correspond to classes. So in logic, on the right-hand side, you apply class to inst 1, and in the symbolic version, in this label node version, you have class as a label node pointing to its only argument inst 1. For example, billionaire of Warren Buffett, and 28 now shows this has instance arrow, subclass arrows, implies arrows, and object identified slots. 29 shows billionaire is subclass of rich. And now let's move to something closer to description logic. We use a conjunction of n classes and exemplify it with someone being billionaire, benefactor, and environmentalist at the same time. And that's a complex node surrounding the three component classes which are intersected, and in description logic we use this square intersection symbol, so it's intentional. But you can also apply it now to Warren Buffett on slide 31, and like we used wavy lines for disjunction of hyperarcs, you can also use it for classes on slide 32. I apply it on slide 33, and slide 34 introduces a top element, which is now used for something really typical for description logics. We now define new classes from given classes and properties. So the top class is being refined. In our example, exist substance physical, meaning at least one value must be typed by class physical. We can apply this newly constructed class to Socrates, and physical will be applied to P1. So the complex class, which is the refinement of the top class, can be applied to Socrates. The dual version of exist is for all that we know from DL languages, and in Crelog is shown on slide 37. 38 shows how to apply a universal restriction. Socrates, who has now two substances, P1 and P2, both of them being physical, so we can apply this complex description to Socrates. 39 shows existential versus universal. If you have a second class, mental, then we could say that P1 is physical, but P3 is mental, and we cannot apply consistently for all substance physical to Socrates anymore. Slide 40 through 43 gives you the well-known lucky parent example and shows how to normalize it in Crelog. Let's move on to 44, object-centered logic, grouping binary relations around an instance. So here you see inst 0 typed by class and having n binary relations going out to inst 1 through n. In symbolic logic, you have a unary relation class applied to inst 0 and n binary ones between inst 0 and something always. So, for instance, we have here Socrates. In the example, the substance P1 is teaching T1. 45 gives us the RDF symbolic form in the right column. And 46, now a more F-logic style representation where we distinguish this OID in 0 with bulleted slot arrows, slot 1 through N. And the right-hand side shows a RIF-like presentation syntax where we use the hash symbol to separate in 0 from its class and use the infix arrow like in F-logic between slot names and fillers. 47 generalizes slots to tuples, so you can also specify the lifetime of Socrates in an ordered manner. And you can combine on slide 48 both slots and tuples. 49 shows you an implication rule, and the example would be a ground rule where Warren Buffett's investment in GE of $3 billion implies JS's investment in VW of 5,000. Now let's move to 50, where we make a non-ground rule where this Y variable is abstracting from which organization the person invests into, and the A variable is not of interest to the investment that JS wants to do. So Psi simulates investment behavior of Warren Buffett. But now in 51, another conjunct is added to the premises, namely JS trust Y. 52 shows the markup we use in rule ML XML for such an implication rule with two conjuncts in the premise. Now 53. Positional slotted term logic, rule defined anonymous family frame. So let's look at this rule. The premise at the bottom mentions that Mary, husband, wife is a conjunctive premise. And the second conjunct is itself a disjunction. So kid, husband, child, or kid, wife, child. Because it's an inclusive or, it could be from both of these parents. And the conclusion is that we have a newly constructed family frame. Type is family. Husband, HU, wife, WI, and child, CH, are slots leading out from a existential variable, underscore question mark one. So what we do here is to generate, operationally speaking, a new OID, but semantically speaking, it's an existential in the head of that rule. On the right-hand side, you see the corresponding symbolic version that we use in WCC RIF. If you now apply this rule to the two given facts, first being married Zhou Su and the second kid Su Pete, you will see that the premise married husband-wife matches the fact with binding HU to Zhou and WI to Su. Then in the disjunction, we check whether HU Zhou has a child, but that's not being mentioned as a fact or being derived by any rule. So we go to the other disjunct, and wife bound to SU to Su is mentioned to have a kid, namely Pete. So CH is bound to Pete. With source bindings, we, so to speak, transport all of the information we found in the premise to the conclusion. And when you go to slide 54, you will see a newly constructed family frame. It's a family frame fact where the object identifier is generated as we apply this rule. For a reference implementation of PSOA rule ML, you can click on this PSOA transrun link and you will find our wiki page. There's much more material. 55 gives you the opposite direction. You have several facts, maybe frame facts and relational facts, and you want to induce this rule. 56. So we have orthogonal graphical features, which are axes of the Kralog systematics. So we have box axes, namely the corners of boxes can be pointed versus snippet versus rounded. This is being done to quote versus 3-5 versus evaluate the content. And that's often done in AI languages and logics for the semantic web, including IKL, for instance. So the shapes of the boxes are all derived from rectangles, and they are composed from sides that are straight versus concave versus convex for neutral versus function versus relation contents. The contents itself can be elementary versus complex nodes. Now proceeding to the arrow axis. So the shafts can be single versus double, heads can be triangular versus diamond, so we inherit from UML part of relations a diamond shape, that's not shown here. Tails can be plain versus bulleted versus having a colon for definitions, also not covered here. Then box and arrow line style axis are solid versus dashed and linear versus wavy, and we have encountered already the wavy for disjunction of boxes. Slide 57 shows two axes, namely corners and shapes. The corners in the three columns are rect, snip, and round, and you can continue to read these bulleted, these bold-faced words like rect, angle, snip, angle, and round angle. These are the first rows, shapes, and then we have two other complex groups of rows, one for individuals, one for propositions. And the individuals can also be adapted for functions, and the propositions also for relations. Slide 58 shows how to apply one of these axes, namely rectangle, snip angle, round angle, to an example of multiplication with a free variable x and a constant 2. If you quote it, even so in your environment x equals 3, you will get the unchanged term, mult x2.
Harold, about 5 minutes.
Yes, thank you. X equals 3, then when you snip angle set, it will be instantiated to mult 3 too. But if you have round angle, again, in this environment, it will not only instantiate it to mult 3-2, but evaluate it to 6. Slide 59 and 60, you should look on your own. Then 61, conclusions. Kralog 1.0 incorporates feedback on earlier versions graphical elements for novel box and arrow systematics using orthogonal graphical features, introducing unique versus non-unique name specification, focus on mapping to a family of logics as in RuleML, use case from cognition, so I used it for teaching logical foundations of cognitive science, and there are other ones, processing of earlier Greylock-like DL8 studied in LispFit and RelFun for Greylock aligned with Web Rule Standard RuleML, and you can find more on the wiki page, especially the part about the test suite. Test suite gives an example about a loan processor. Data log rules that are used and visualized. Slide 62, symbolic to visual translators started as fall term projects last year, and especially Team One did a visualizer for Greylock data log that is ready for use as an XSLT script. Greylock invites feature choice or combination, e.g. you can now freely choose if you want to use NLE hyperarchs or N-slot frames, or a combination of both. The Greylock initiative is an open standard and calls for feedback on future versions. And future work on 63 includes refining, extending Greylock, e.g. along this API for KB by ONG, compared also with conceptual graphs, map to UML and back, implement further tools for generators of Greylock, and that is this tool I mentioned, but also passes for editing Greylock visually, graph indexing, querying, transformation, and path tracing. Slide 64, develop a Greylock structure editor, for instance, for auto-specializing these neutral boxes, benefit and contribute to Protégé visualization plugins such as Jambalaya, proceed from 2D Greylock to a 3D version, and consider the false temporal dimension of animations to visualize logical inferences, graph processing, etc. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you very much, Harold. Kind of a whirlwind tour, but very interesting. Our next speaker is Benjamin Grossoff. He's going to be speaking on HiLog, the feasibility and the foundations of practical meta-knowledge. A brief introduction. Benjamin?
Okay, so nice to be here. It's great to have this mini-series going. I'm going to be really doing a kind of a tutorial here. It doesn't have conclusions or future work the way Harold's did, so just be aware of that going into this. Okay, so what I'm going to be speaking about are several practical features of meta-knowledge. The most mature current logical KR in this regard is RuleLog. However, these features can apply to other logical KRs as well. So what are the meta features in RuleLog today? Overall, these mix meta-knowledge with what we call non-meta or base knowledge at pretty fine grain, just as the web puts the meta in data and mixes it fine grain and ditto markup more generally in XML and so on, with non-meta, that is kind of base data in fine grain. Well, the first key aspect of these meta features for more expressive kinds of knowledge beyond metadata is HiLog, being able to treat any atom, or more generally any literal, as a term. This is used also in common logic, and this provides essentially the syntax of higher order, a bit restricted, but the semantics reduces via a local and low computational complexity transformation to first order. So the semantics is first order, but the syntax is higher order, and that provides enormous convenience syntactically. It's much closer to natural language, and it's very nice for a lot of other purposes, as we'll see shortly. Now, this transformation heavily uses logical functions in the general case, and so often introduces logical functions when in the original higher order syntax, if you just looked at it, you wouldn't see something that corresponded to logical functions. It also permits logical functions to be used in a much freer way in the syntax. For example, complex terms can be used as predicates or in the function position before a tuple of arguments. We'll see more about that shortly. But whenever you see HiLog, think, hey, I'm going to need to deal with logical functions when I'm doing implementation. And that is an important ramification. Another thing a bit more general than HiLog is reification. Any formula can be treated as a term. This is often called quoting of formulas as well. And so, for example, this enables one to represent modals very straightforwardly, because the idea of a modal is that you have some kind of operator, which you can think of as a function or a predicate. A lot of times you can think of it as either, depending on where it appears, that is then applied to a formula as its argument or within its scope. So reification is more general than HiLog because an atom is a special case of a formula, or a literal is a special case of a formula. Now, common logic has kind of shied away from reification. You want to have some restrictions on reification, just like you want to have a bit of restrictions on the higher order syntax in HiLog to get things to have a good semantics and work out well. I'm not going to be going into those details, but for in essence, there aren't so many formulas that you have to worry about whether you can treat them or not. Most you can. The third thing is very humble, rule IDs. It's deceptively simple. There's some history and logic of treating these. For example, labeled formulas and so on. Dev Gabai wrote a whole book about labeled logic, which kind of is related to rule IDs. But pretty much every practical system that implements rules or knowledge-based systems has a rule ID in the system. It's used for editing and debugging and various other kinds of purposes. But what we're doing here is putting rule IDs into the language. And what that enables is then you have a hook to make meta statements about assertions. So in RULOG, every assertion has a rule ID. It's just a constant in a logical language. You could either state it explicitly in the syntax, or if not, it's there as a scolon. And this is useful for a variety of purposes, including provenance, where you may make statements about when a rule was created or who edited it, or what its source was in other ways. Also, for defeasibility, where you want to talk about this rule has higher priority than that rule. You need a way to talk about this and that. For restraint, which is a form of bounded rationality, which gets handled in RULOG in a way that is roughly parallel in some ways to defeasibility, or analogous to it, excuse me, and for some various other purposes as well. So it's basically a simple and convenient hook to make statements about other statements that are specifically not just formulas, but which have the force of being an assertion in the knowledge base. Now, the next thing is defeasibility. I've bold-faced defeasibility in HiLog, because in what follows, I'm going to really be focusing more mostly on HiLog and defeasibility. The concept of defeasibility is that any rule can have exceptions in the non-monotonic sense. That is, it can be defeated, which is the basis for the terminology, defeasible or defeasibility. Along with that, one introduces a stronger form of negation as an extension of declarative logic in the extension of declarative logic programs, along with the weaker form of negation, NAF, or negation is failure, also known as weak negation or sometimes as default negation. Now, defeasibility includes having essentially then pro and con arguments that one can have about a particular atom or about a literal and its neg, and handles inconsistency type conflicts, including using prioritization often. Rules can be canceled, that is purely defeated or undercut as well. Now, the state of the art now in defeasibility is an approach called argumentation theories, where one can specify via rules the principles of defeat or debate. And what's interesting is then defeasibility is making use of the high log feature and the rule ID feature that I talked about a few moments ago. So the argumentation theory approach is very elegant from a computational and semantic and theoretical viewpoint. It has many advantages, but it rides on top of having the high log and the rule ID features within the language. Finally, I'm not going to focus a whole lot on it, but just give you a bit of a hint here. There is a form of bounded rationality in RuLog that uses the undefined truth value, which in addition to true and false in the NAF sense, is available in unextended logic programs under the well-founded semantics, which is the typical one that's used. This undefined truth value represents intuitively not bothering to figure out whether the truth value is true versus false in the NAF sense. And then one can specify via rules the principles of such not bothering. Does that remind you of anything? Sure, it's similar to this argumentation theory approach. So one specific type of restraint is to treat as you every atom, or more generally every literal, whose size as a term, that is, whose syntactic size, the number of constants and variables, etc., appearing in it, exceeds a fixed radius. So by doing that, you limit the depth, in a certain sense, of reasoning, and everything beyond that depth becomes fog. It becomes this U truth value. And that enables one, at will, to restrain the reasoning involved in this fairly rich logical KR in such a way that you can guarantee tractability, polytime for inferencing. Moving on to slide three, let's look at some examples of the different types of meta-knowledge that I mentioned, just to kind of reinforce the concepts here. So reification makes a term out of a formula. Here we have that John believes this dollar sign curly brace thingy, which is circled in blue, which is likes of Mary, comma, Bob. So likes of Mary, comma, Bob here is a term made out of the formula, out of the atom, likes Mary, comma, Bob. And we're asserting that John believes that formula. Now, variables can be backquoted, which is convenient. Let's take a look at the next example formula here, that John believes that Mary likes X implies that John is jealous of X. So here the scope of X is outside of the quoted formula. It's really at the scope that is outermost in that whole rule. So we're saying that it's not just that John believes the formula likes Mary X. That is the precondition. It's not that, you know, Mary likes somebody, that if he likes that, then there's some other X John is jealous of. John is jealous of all and sundry. No, it's the same X in both, and to get that to happen, to specify our intent syntactically, we use the backquoting mechanism. Now, backquoting, of course, has been used for many years in many programming languages, Lisp and whatnot, Lambda calculus, other kinds of higher order or modal languages, et cetera, people have used backquoting. So I'm not going to try to beat the point in, but I just want to get across that backquoting is different from regular quoting, but it is a very nice extension of the basic reification mechanism. Another nice extension is that rules, not just formulas, can be reified as well. Next, let's look at some examples of high log. Remember, high log is a special case of reification. It permits predicates and functions to be any term. In particular, a predicate or a function could be a variable, or a predicate or a function could be a complex term formed out of applying a function to a tuple of arguments. And here, rather abstractly, I've got an example that shows exactly that kind of syntax happening. So here in the body of the rule, x of a z, x, the predicate position is x, which is a variable. In the second condition in the body, we have y of f of z in turn applied to b. So here y is, y again there is a predicate. I'm sorry, that's a typo on the slide. But then we have a complex term where f of z is being used as a function. Now, Hilog also permits variables over atomic formulas, and this is a kind of reification. So we see here in the example at the bottom, r of x if p of x and x, the whole condition x is a variable. Now, one of the few restrictions that Hilog imposes is that such a variable appearing in lieu of an atom should not appear in the head of the rule. Partly that's for practical reasons. So if you're interested in more about the details, I encourage you to go look at some of the papers by Michael Kiefer and his collaborators who developed this Hilog approach, which, as I mentioned, is also used in common logic. Moving on to slide 5. Rule IDs, simple but important feature. The ID is explicitly specified if you desire. Here the syntax used in the middle is @bang followed by curly braces, and that's a kind of annotation as a prefix to the main rule, the main formula, if you will, of the rule, which says H if B. Now, if the ID is omitted, it is treated as implicit, as essentially a scolon. So if you write just H if B in the language Rulog, that gets treated as @bang with some generated symbol, which I wrote here as gensim0897 to get across. It's just some random scolon constant, then followed again by the main formula. And this enables various useful kinds of meta-knowledge. So, for example, I could say, my rule 17 was created by Benjamin. It also is used for defeasibility, for restraint of some kinds, as I mentioned. And more generally, it's very useful for rule-based transformations, for example, to extend the language, to do UI, to do natural language processing, where you are mapping one form of rule into another. Moving on to slide 6. Now, let's think of Hilog reification and rule IDs as one group of stuff that let us make meta-statements about formulas and assertions. Overall, what are the uses of this kind of stuff? For knowledge exchange and for introspection. We can view those as the category for a lot of these uses. So those include doing mappings about ontology. It's very convenient, for example, to say systematically that certain expressions map into other expressions when you're doing ontology mapping for knowledge integration, and when doing knowledge-based translation or importation. They're useful for having KR macros, which expand. So you can think of that as a kind of simple case of rule-based transformation. For modals, including should or deontic modals, obligation, permission, prohibition, etc., as well as alethic, you can, it's possible, you must, something is necessarily true, etc., which are used, for example, in SBVR. For multi-agent belief, reification is essential. As I mentioned, for provenance, there are many other aspects of context which one can use these things for control of reasoning, including this restraint or bounded rationality technique, for modularizing knowledge bases, because you can more easily talk about statements or formulas in terms of groupings, or during querying, how you might want to treat and present information, or more generally to do navigation during the process of knowledge acquisition, and as I mentioned, in this argumentation theory approach to defeasibility, it's applied. Both HILOG and rule IDs are used. Moving on to slide 7, the HILOG semantics, as I mentioned, is defined via transformation. A simplified version of that, which gives the intuition, is that when you see an atom, here let's for specificity say that has arity 2, and it says P of A comma B, where P, A, and B are all constants, that gets rewritten into something that says we're going to treat P, A, and B as a triple of arguments, all wrapped inside of another predicate that is used generically whenever we rewrite an atom of arity 2. We can use this new holding predicate that corresponds to what was originally arity 2. We'll call that holds underscore 2 here. So there are a small set of generic predicate constants. If we say only consider arities up to 10, we only need 10 of those. this was once upon a time when back in the 80s called the holds trick in knowledge representation. So it is a simple way to if P or A or B is a variable or a complex term, that variable or complex term becomes an argument in the argument tuple. And now holds, which is just a constant, holds sub I, here holds sub 2, is applied to that tuple of terms. So we can start with atoms that freely mention complex terms or variables in the function or predicate position and map them into atoms that have constants. In other words, are first order in that regard. In the predicate or function position. Now, as part of doing this, we treat each term in a similar manner using another set of generic constants that are function constants. So the term f of ab, if f is a complex term, f ends up as an argument within this apply sub 2 functional term with a and b also carried along for the ride. So the general case of transformation, as I mentioned before, heavily uses logical functions, and that creates a challenge in implementing HILOG from an efficiency and an inferencing algorithmic viewpoint. So probably the most sophisticated implementation of HILOG in the world is the one that is in Flora 2, which has gone open source under Apache, and which whose extension proprietarily is part of the Coherent Knowledge Systems suite of software, the startup that I and Michael Kiefer and several other people have just created this summer. Moving on to slide 8, knowledge often has exceptions. So now we're jumping off that group of back to slide 2.
Benjamin, we have about 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you. So remember we talked about this group of HILOG, reification, and rule ID. Next we're going to talk about defeasibility. Back to slide 8. Knowledge is, another way to say this is knowledge is defeasible, that is, can be defeated. So consider the following statement. A eukaryotic cell has a nucleus. Well, except when it doesn't. For example, such a cell has no nucleus during a certain phase of its life cycle. And red blood cells, which is a special case of eukaryotic cells, never have nuclei. Sometimes a cell has two nuclei. So exceptions or special cases are inevitably realized over time. Knowledge is incomplete, multiple authors contribute. So when we think about a knowledge base evolving, including the knowledge base of the human species, or probably of other species as well, animals, aliens, etc., one learns about exceptions, and that may be literally inductive learning from empirical observation. Requiring knowledge that's entered into a knowledge base to be strictly or universally true, that is exception-free, is fairly impractical in many settings because it precludes stating generalities, that is the typical, then being able to be followed by having exception information about exceptions be specified. And that greatly restricts the population of authors if they have to specify things that are guaranteed to be exception-free forever, as it were. So one way to think about this is it's an instance of the old motto, the perfect is the enemy of the good. Now, exceptions manifest as contradictions or contradictory-type conflict. Leveraging multiple sources of knowledge when you're doing semantic web, large-scale knowledge integration, etc., and have to merge knowledge that has been developed by different organizations or authors at different times, etc., requires resolving such conflicts. Any person who's not a computer expert can tell you that it's very unlikely you won't get such conflicts, that you'll get zero such conflicts as you do in classical logic, which is perfectly brittle. Why do these conflicts arise? Sometimes it's just human error. Sometimes it's confusions about, say, meanings of terms. Or it may be that context was implicit in the development of the original development of knowledge bases in various knowledge sources and needs to be made more explicit as part of the knowledge integration process. But until you do, you don't want to totally break. Moving on to slide 9. So defeasibility is indicated when useful generalities and potential exceptions coexist because it enables you to specify in the level of detail or precision that is appropriate for various circumstances. Oh, we'll get to that later. We can just state the general or the typical to start with. So it may be that there's no central authority that resolves all conflict promptly. Or that truth depends on context, but context is not made fully explicit all the time, partly for reasons of efficiency in communication, or just awareness and memory. So many broad realms are full of exceptions, policies, regulations, laws, the workflows that are associated with those, learning and science where you have updating and debate and you may falsify after observation or communication, the hypotheses that you had around before. Causal processes were changes to state or interactions between multiple causes have long been recognized that you want to use defeasibility to represent those in an agile and natural way. And natural language, for example, natural language understanding or text interpretation used in knowledge authoring or acquisition, there's a gazillion special cases. Here's an example of how this looks in RULOG. A vendor wishes to share for supply chain management how long ahead a buyer must place or modify an order. And there's several rules that come from different parts of the organization, say 14 days ahead if the buyer is qualified and been checked out in a certain sense, or 30 days ahead if it's a minor part. The bean counters have noticed you're getting killed if you deal with it on too short a timeline. Otherwise, 2 days ahead if the type of the item is backlogged at the vendor and the order is to reduce the modification to reduce the quantity of the item as well as the buyer being qualified, or the Joe Blow rule if the buyers just will walk in 45 days ahead. And then you can have precedence between the rules. Say that the 2-day rule C is higher priority than the 14-day rule for A. They're both about qualified customers, but the 2-day ahead rule was a special case of that. So one can then encode the rules. We see out to the left tags prefixed by @ before each rule, and then down under them we see this overrides, and that's a special predicate stating that the tag of the rule, the 2-day rule, is higher priority, that is overrides the tag of the first rule about 14 days. And there's a bit of other notational hair there I'm not going to get into here, but you can look at the slides later. Now, moving on to slide 12, here's an example. I'm not going to go through it in a great deal of detail, but that uses HighLog plus exceptions and gives an example of doing information integration, ontology mapping, where the mapping itself has some defeasibility. So say you have a company that's reporting various accounting things, its operating earnings, et cetera, and another organization wants to view that information. Most of that information gets brought over with the same category. Look at that normally bring over rule, the first rule there. It gets brought over as a category according to GG as the same category it was according to the source BB. But there are certain exceptions. So if a small company is acquired for the sake of its intellectual property, it may be reported under one category in the source company, but organization GG wants to view it more conventionally in terms of a notion of operating cost that excludes the acquisition amount, whereas BB reports pro forma, that is according to its own definitions, and includes the price of an acquired small company as part of intellectual property expenditures, which, like other R&D, are treated as operating costs. Moving on to slide 13, which is about causal chains, here's some examples of causality from biology. Where you can have hypothetical questions, you can have counterfactual questions, say a researcher treats a chemical that prevents DNA synthesis from starting, the cells get trapped in which part of the cell cycle, or suppose the typical number of chromosomes in a human liver cell was 12, or is it actually 46, how many chromosomes would there be in a human sperm cell? So the change of state relative to persistence of previous state, or one cause interfering with another cause's typical effects, are both well represented using defeasibility, has been recognized for decades in the area of reasoning about action. Moving on to slide 14, we can think about there being several high-level categories of priority information. Priority information in defeasibility is treated as first-class information. It could be based on recency, authority, reliability, closed world, as well as what we were seeing, specificity and causality in the examples we saw earlier. Authority is very important with policies and regulations and laws. Many practical rule systems employ priorities of some kind, often implicit and not terribly semantic. There was an earlier approach to the argumentation theory approach called courteous logic programs and something very similar called defeasible logic that were developed, moving on to slide 15, that have been the most important in practice. And in the Vulcan Silk effort, we pursued extending the courteous approach and developed some theoretical unification with defeasible logic. Courteous, the earlier version, was developed back in the late 90s at IBM and has been used in RuleNL. And moving on to slide 16, the argumentation theory's approach takes the spirit of courteous, combines it with HighLog, generalizes, and then you can essentially specify different nuances in the behavior of defeasibility via these meta rules. It only takes, you know, order a few tens of rules in the LP itself to specify even a fairly complicated argumentation theory. And this has a number of advantages, as I mentioned earlier. Slide 17, this argumentation theory's approach and courteous have some very nice semantic properties, have a well-developed model theory, reducibility and well-behavior results, and extend the semantics of previous approaches. So they've been somewhat well-studied already, although there's certainly more to do theoretically about them. And they've been implemented in Flora 2, in Silk, in coherent knowledge systems technology, and earlier approaches, the courteous and the defeasible logic, have been done in a number of systems, mostly research systems, but commercial as well in the case of courteous. For more information, I encourage you, slide 18, to look at a long rules tutorial, which has been given a number of times at different conferences since 2004 which you can get at the web URL listed here on the Coherent website. And earlier in the last session of Analog Forum, I gave a survey of KRs that this kind of continued and elaborated on. And for an overview of RULOG overall, including some aspects of knowledge acquisition and more examples material, I encourage you to listen to as well as see the June 20th session of Analog Forum. Now, none of those cover restraint in as much detail as would be ideal because restraint was only developed fairly recently as a technique. However, there are three papers that came out this year that talk about restraint, and they're listed here at the bottom of the slide. Thanks very much for your attention.
Thank you, Benjamin. Very interesting talk. Our next speaker is George Gottlob. I guess your co-author, Andreas Pieris, is not present. George?
Very good. So given that I'm new to this forum, let me very briefly introduce myself. So my name is George or Georg Gottlob, as you like. I mean, here in England, everybody calls me George due to the many King Georges, etc. So my original name is Georg. I have been in Oxford for 8 years, but I come from Vienna originally and from TU Vienna, and that's why my English is not really an Oxford English, as you have noticed probably. I have a background in databases, AI, theoretical computer science, and I have a really great interest in the data log language, and I've worked for many, many years on data log, on different aspects of data log, a very simple rule-based language that was used in the database community and is used, still used, and has a kind of revival recently. However, I tried to do what people in description logic were doing in data log, but as Horrocks already noticed many years ago, data log alone is not enough. So I was looking with my different co-authors, to how to extend data log to capture as much as possible with as few constructs as possible. So I kind of basically what we wanted to do is a minimalistic extension of data log to obtain a maximal expressive power while remaining decidable and where possible tractable. So this basically led to this data log plus minus language. I will explain what plus minus here means. So these slides were prepared with Andreas Pieris, but unfortunately Andreas can't be here today because it was quite a short notice that I was invited, so, and then he had some other thing to do. Anyway, let's go to page 2. So our language, data log plus minus, is designed to capture various kind of formalisms for ontological data presentation, like for instance UML class diagrams, description logics, some part of F-logic, which in a certain sense is related to HiLog, of course, because that's what F-logic was the basis for it, but also some languages like Sparkle. And that's what I want to show today. Of course, what I will say today, these few minutes that I have, will be very incomplete, and I will not mention many, many aspects, so it will be very rudimentary. Let's go to slide 3. So basically, what we want to do is data log plus minus should be a kind of logical foundation for these languages that allows you to make clear statements about semantics and decidability, that allows you to derive complexity results, especially for something which we call ontological query answering. That means query answering is a kind of reasoning task where you can, at the end, pose a query. So you have a database, an A box, if you want. You have a set of rules which correspond, in some sense, to a T box, and then you can answer a query. And this subsumes several other reasoning tasks like concept emptiness, consistency, etc. You can all code that into queries. So I will only speak about query answering here, but I mean it's understood that other reasoning tasks can be done in a similar way, because query answering is already a pretty complex reasoning task. And when I speak about queries here, for the moment I speak about conjunctive queries. And another important point is identification of tractable fragments. So let's go to slide 4. On top of slide 4, you see a rule for each XY, father of XY and person of Y implies person of X. Of course, we leave the universal quantifiers out. But here, in order to make it explicit, I write them. And of course, they extend over the entire formula. So this is a typical data log rule that all of you probably know. Data log is just like function-free logic programming with a well-defined semantics. And as I said, data log is not enough. And therefore, we will extend data log. And the three main extensions, and then there are others, of course. There's this junction, et cetera, that I will not speak about today, and also negation in rule bodies that I will not speak, but where we have papers. The main extensions are existential quantifiers in rule heads. So here you see this is also a database theory. This is called TGDs, tuple generating dependencies, but now let's just call it existential rules. So for instance, for each person, for each X, if person X, then there exists Y, father Y of X, and person Y. So that would be a rule that has an existential quantifier in its head, which is not covered by standard data log. The second type of extension that we consider is equalities in rule heads. So we could, in this sense, formulate what in database is called functional dependency or equality generating dependency. So for each X, Y, Z, if Y is the father of X, and if Z is the father of X, then Y must be equal to Z, as you see. And what we also want is we want to be able to formulate constraints, and that's the third type of extension. For each X, Y, father of Y, X, and mother of Y, X implies false. So Y cannot be both the father and mother, so that implies false. Okay, so this is a very simple, these are very simple extensions, but unfortunately, query answering, if we only take the first extension, namely existential quantifiers, was shown long time ago in 81, actually by Berry and Vardy, or it's an immediate consequence of a result by Berry and Vardy, query answering is undecided. So if we call data log plus data log with such extensions, we will on the other hand need again some restrictions to rule bodies. So we need to have syntactic restrictions, so in order to get decidability. And that's why the language is called data log plus minus, because on one hand we extend data log with such nice features, on the other hand we have to restrict it to get decidability and even better complexity. So what is query answering? Query answering is to have a database also known as a box, assertion box. We have an ontology also known as T-box. And of course, this ontology or these rules, these data log plus minus rules, this ontology now consists of data log plus minus rules. That's on slide 5. Generate new facts. And so we get something which is much larger than the database. And now we want to pose queries against this kind of extension. And that is it. And if you have existential quantifiers, then we have certainly to consider several rules. So let's go to slide 6. So we have a database that has person of John. John is a person, that's the only fact in my database. And then I have, of course, this is not a realistic one, but that's just for example purposes, for illustration purposes. Then you have O, you have a rule set for each P. Person P implies there exists an F, father of FP. F is the father of P. Each person has a father. And for each F, for each P, if F is the father of P, then F is also a person. And so, of course, from this database consisting only of one fact and from these two rules, we can now infer that there must be, that given that John is a person, there must exist some father. So we have basically invented a null value for it. Could be a kind of Skolem constant, if you want, is Z, father of John Z, and Z is a person. But once I have this, I can answer queries. So can I say there exists a father of, so a Boolean query would be, does there exist an X such that X is the father of John and person X? And the answer is yes. Does there exist an X such that father of John X? No, because this is not in my database. Okay? So I can answer Boolean queries, and in a certain sense I can also answer non-Boolean queries as long as I restrict my interest to constants of the original database, but I will not now go into detail here. But this is just to give you an impression how query answering is. Let's go to slide number 7. Now we have, using these three additions, existential quantifiers, equality, and basically negative constraints. We have identified three large fragments, basically two main fragments. One is guarded data log, the other is sticky data log, and another smaller fragment, which is linear data log, which is part of guarded data log, that are decidable and that are, in our opinion, very useful for modeling knowledge. So let me come first to guarded data log. Guarded data log can in a certain sense be seen as a part of guarded logic, and guarded logic was studied by Andre Carnemity, Van Bentem, by Gradle, etc. It's a decidable fragment of first order logic, and the rules that we have here are actually in that fragment. However, the queries do not necessarily need to be guarded, and so we had to show that even if you have conjunctive queries that are not guarded, everything remains decidable. So let's see what a guarded rule is. Here is the first rule on slide number 8 is a guarded rule. A guarded rule is one that contains a guard in its body, that is an atom that contains all variables of all variables that occur in the ruled body. So manager of ED contains E, and D, and there is no other variable in the ruled body, so it's one single atom that contains all variables, and so this rule is a guarded rule. And one can show using quite technical tricks about bounded trivials, etc., that guarded query answering, not only guarded logic, as was already shown by Gradle, but even conjunctive query answering based on guarded theories, and in particular on guarded data log plus minus, is decidable. And a very important point is the last one, slide number 8, namely guarded logic, guarded data log plus minus, query answering for guarded data log plus minus is in p-time and p-time complete when we restrict our attention to data complexity, which is what people are usually interested in, so that the ontology is fixed, and so the T box is fixed, the query is fixed, but the A box can be very large. And this is what people in databases at least are interested in, but even I think when you look at the large ontologies, what is really becomes big is this defect phase. Let's go to slide 9. Linear data log is a subformalism of guarded data log. It uses rules with only one body atom, okay? And if we have ontologies that are built only from such rules, and I will come back to that later, such ontologies, if you have queries and ontologies, they are first order rewritable. So basically you could translate an ontology and a query made of such rules into basically a single SQL query. And therefore, basically you can handle everything that is expressible in this type, in this relatively restricted, but on the other hand also relatively still expressive data log plus minus with just a standard SQL engine. And why do I say that this is still relatively expressive? Because as we will see later, this linear data log with existential quantifiers already captures description logic such as dear light. So I can do a huge lot with them, and one can translate that into basically SQL, and the complexity is therefore very low. It's AC0, which is the complexity of first order logic. Let's go to slide 10. Another class, very interesting class, and this is really something completely new. It's not related to anything that we have seen before, whereas guarded was related to the guarded fragment, but here sticky is not related to anything. It's a new decidable class of rules where we can do actually joins, because in the guarded you can do joins, but not proper joins or Cartesian products, etc. Here you can do joins, so here you see a rule for each PNA, project PN and in area PA, there exists the director of DPA. So you see basically you join in database terms two relations, or you join two roles or whatever here, and created a ternary predicate or a ternary relation. And normally this is highly undecidable, but we have identified a property that makes this decidable, namely the stickiness, sticky property. Sticky means if we join, here in this case, that the join variable is P, as you see, project P in area PA, project PN, so we join over the same P, then this P must appear also in the rule head. So this is for a single rule, And the stickiness condition is a little bit more complex than that, but it's easily checkable. It says that even if we have several rules, and you know, you cannot simulate it, but whenever we have several rules, the P cannot get lost. So I cannot now project this P out, because that would be a simple trick to get rid of the P. Just use another rule that projects it out. That is forbidden with DB rules. Okay. So again, we have a very good complexity properties here. Sticky rules are again first order rewritable. Queries to sticky series are first order rewritable, and it has the same good data complexity. So now we can, I spoke so far about data log with existential quantifiers, but as long as we have non-conflicting equalities, and I don't explain now what that means, but it is standard also in description logic. You cannot just use equality constraints as much as you want. They don't have to conflict in a certain sense with existential constraints. We can add them, and we can also add negative constraints, and the complexity remains the same. So these are our basic formalisms. And now I will show you what we can do with those formalisms. Okay? So let's first go to UML class diagrams. Of course, I will only give you a quick glimpse. I will not go into detail again. So here you have a UML diagram. Look at this at slide 13. You have this UML class diagram. Basically, if you have a database, the database is, forget about the red facts on the left-hand side. These are facts that are inferred in a certain sense. So just look at the database, executive John, member John, Lufthansa, stock Bay, issues Bay, BA, British Airways Bay, owns John Bay, competes Lufthansa BA, etc. Now, we have an UML diagram. So this is a database. This is an extension of the database. On the right-hand side, we have a UML diagram. The UML diagram says that every company must issues one or more on the stock market, of course. Every company on the stock market issues one or several stocks. Every stock is only issued by one company. A person can own several stocks, et cetera, an executive is a person. So you see, this is the standard UML diagram. And of course, now this UML diagram, actually, with this incomplete database on the left-hand side, with the black facts on the left-hand side, generates new facts. Why? Because we have, for instance, executive John, and then every executive is a person, so we will generate person Johns. So this is very similar to what happens in description logics. And now you can ask queries, and this would be a query, what you see at the bottom here, is there a conflict of interest? So the query, person P, company C1, company C2, stock S, owns PS, so P, person P owns stock of a company S, owns a stock, sorry, stock type S, stock type S is issued by a company two. Person is a member in company one. That means a member of the board of company one. And C2 is a competitor of C1, competes C1, C2. This is my definition of what the conflict is. You can ask this question, is there a conflict? Now, this question answered to the original database wouldn't give us anything because the original database was complete. But together with the facts generated by this UML class diagram, is yes, there is a conflict. Okay, let's go to the next slide, slide 14. Well, that's the same basically. Let's go to slide 15 now. Now, how can we translate UML diagrams? This is not completely new. It has been done. Translations of UML diagram have been done between. There were translations between UML diagrams and description logics, but we do that now. What is new now that we do it into Datalog plus minus. So as you can see, we can translate this into logical formulas that are in Datalog plus minus. For each X, company X implies there exists Y, issues XY, issues some stock. Each listed company must issue some stock, etc., etc. I will not go to the details due to time reasons. But you see that we can translate this into Datalog plus minus, and then we can just ask queries, and we can use the query answering of Datalog plus minus. And we have identified a very large fragment that's on slide number 16. We have identified a very large fragment called lean UMS class diagrams. I will not define them here, but it's a very large fragment that makes a lot of sense where query answering is actually polynomial. And as you can see on slide 16, this fragment, the rules that we use here are basically guarded rules of a certain type. And we can prove that these rules, queer answering is, and it is known actually for guarded rules, queer answering is polynomial. So we have identified a large class of UML diagrams thanks to data log plus minus that translate into a fragment of data log plus minus which is polynomial. And interestingly, these seem exactly to be the UML diagrams that come if you do reverse engineering and look at software and try to filter out UML diagrams. That is what we get. Let's go to slide 17 now. Now we go to description logics. Let's go to slide 18. Here you see how description logics translate into data log plus minus. Namely, not all description logics. Description logics in general are much more complex. But we look here first. Let's have a look at the DL. Light family of description logics invented by the Romans, namely by Calvanese, De Giacomo, Lembo, Lanzarini, etc. These very smoothly translate into data log plus minus and into a fragment of data log plus minus which has a slightly higher expressive power but still the same complexity. Now then on slide 19 I show you the EL family. The EL family EL is another family of description logics that also contains R2 EL and also for querying R2 QL. And here you have on slide number 19, you have on the left hand side the different constructs that you have in different sub languages of ELHI, which is a neg, which is a superset of EL, and you can see that intersection smoothly translates into actually guarded. Everything translates into actually guarded data log plus minus. Just have a quick look. I will not go through the single lines, but it's obvious that this translation is actually obvious. What is maybe interesting to notice is if you look at the last two rules, these last two rules are not guarded, but we don't need that because these are just constraints. Constraints don't need to be guarded. So we can add non-guarded constraints. So A square bracket included into not B, there's a kind of disjointness constraint. It says A and B are disjoint classes, and the most obvious way of translating that into data log plus minus or into logic in general is to say for each X, A of X and B of X implies false. And we can do the same thing for roles and not just for concepts, and that's the last line here. But what is important to notice is the guardedness, we need guardedness only for the positive rules, not for constraints, not for rules that have faults in their rule head. There we can have arbitrary rule bodies, and adding such rules doesn't add complexity, because these are basically just conjunctive queries that we have to solve. Let's go to slide 20. So here is just a summary. DLite actually can be translated both to linear and to sticky data log plus minus. ELHI neg, which is a superset of EL, is translated into guarded. And actually, guarded linear or sticky data log each are more expressive actually. So for instance, you have a rule called CEO of EE implies manager of EE. This is what you cannot express in basic description logics. Yeah, but we have, of course, we also have many other things. I mean, we have unlimited arity, so we have hypergraphs, hyper edges, as Dr. Bolle said, rather than just edges, etc. So we have basically a very nice and round fragment of logic here. Now let me go to slide number 21, and here we have F logic. F logic is also related to what the previous speaker has said, Ben. But also what Harold has said, it's also related to Harold's, certainly to Harold's talk. So we will not, of course, capture the full F logic because full F logic is undecidable. We would capture it with data log plus, but not with data log plus, decidable fragments of data log plus minus. But we were looking for a decidable fragment of data log plus minus. This captures a decidable fragment of F logic, namely F logic lite, as defined by F logic light was defined by Kali and Kiefer in a VLDB 2006 paper. And F logic light is basically a very interesting encoding of a single of typing, etc., by a single logic program that you see on slide number 22. Slide number 22, you see a number.
George, about 5 minutes.
Yes, slide number 22, you see rules like type OAT, so if an object has an attribute of type T, and if this object has the attribute A of object O has data with value V, then V must be of type T, etc. So such very nice rules. I think it's a very nice piece of work here to encode lots of interesting things into a single logic programming and actually into a single data log program. Of course, it's not a pure data log program, because you have here also a non-conflicting EGD, and you have also a kind of TGD at some point here. But the interesting, what we want first to observe, please go to slide 24, that this program is actually not a guarded program. And here you have seen that there are many, many rule bodies that are not guarded, where you have two different atoms that each contain different variables, and there's no atom that contains all variables of the rule body. So just look at the first rule, type OAT and data OAV implies memberVT. So none of these two, neither OAT nor OAV contains all variables, so this is not guarded. So we had to look for a more expressive data log language, and this is described on slide number 25. So we looked for a weakly guarded language, and basically in the weakly guarded language we said actually we don't need to guard all variables of a logic program. We actually only need to guard those variables through a guard that can eventually contain values that are created through as kind of null values or function terms or scolem terms, if you want, through existential variables in the rule heads. And not existential variables don't affect everything, so only affected positions need to be guarded. So that's the basic idea. I mean, it would be too long to tell you much more about it, but it's a new, basically, formalism, weakly guarded data log, and again, we have finite trivias, and generally, weakly guarded data log is time-complete, even for data complexity, but in addition, we have a certain criterion. For this criterion, we can show that it's a polynomial. Let's go to slide number 24. Let's go to slide number 26. In slide number 26, we see that if we see what are really the affected positions here. Now, again, I don't have the time to do that in detail. Data one means the first argument of data, the third argument of the data predicate, the first argument of type, the first argument of member, the second argument of mandatory, the second argument of fact. These are really the affected positions. And if we can only consider those positions, then actually, with respect to those positions, our program is guarded, and therefore it is weakly guarded. And the guards are here on slide number 26, are the red things, the red atoms. Finally, last, it's not absolutely the last thing I want to say, but almost the last thing, let's go to Sparkle, and I will very quickly, let's go to slide number 29, jump to slide number 29. I will just show you that we can translate Sparkle to data log plus minus. Here we need data log plus minus plus stratified negation. So let's go to slide number 30. Here you have a Sparkle query. List all pairs O1, O2, such that O2 is the name of O1. Well, this is very easy. Triple X name Y implies PXY. PXY is the answer predicate. So that's clear that you can do that even in data log. You don't need existential quantifiers. You don't need negation here. List elements that have a name. PX name B. That would be the Sparkle query, and the data log corresponding data log query is triple X name Y implies P of X. Okay? Now, here comes a more sophisticated query, an opt expression in Sparkle, X name Y opt, X, that's on slide 32, X name Y opt X phone Y, for every subject O return O, the name of O and the phone number of O if the phone number is available, otherwise return O and it's just O and its name. So basically we create two relations, one relation P and one relation P prime, and P should contain all objects, names and phone numbers if the phone number is available, and otherwise subject has a phone number, subject and names. Well, this can be done by the following Sparkle query. For each x, y, triple x, name y, and triple x, phone z, sorry, the following data log plus minus query, I meant, triple x, name y, triple x, phone z, implies p of x, y, z, and compatible z. So whenever there is a phone number, we also assert effect compatible. And then we say for each x, y, if x, name y, and not compatible x, then just add p prime x, y, and so we create a second relation. Now it can also be seen that you need, that for doing Sparky you need also existential quantifiers, but I will not go to this. Let me just say that Sparky can be translated fully, full Sparky, not only Sparky. Let's go to slide 35. Full Sparky with RDFS and OWL vocabularies, navigational capabilities, and recursion in addition, all this can be translated into data log into a decidable fragment of data log exists with negation, stratified negation, and constraints, and that is as complex as Sparky, but more expressive. Now, finally, let's go to slide 36. This is an overview. We have shown that several different formalisms can be translated into different subformalisms of data log plus minus. And now let me ask myself actually about implementations. I want to speak speaking about implementations. There are not that many implementations yet of data log plus minus, but there is one, and I have the implementer here with me, Giorgio Orsi. He is my collaborator, and he's here, and he has implemented one system. And maybe he can say, to finish this talk, he can say you a few words about this implementation and some other existing implementations on the next slide. These are the last two slides. So please go to slide number 37, and Giorgio also will briefly fill you in about the implementation.
Hello. I'm Giorgio Orsi. I'm one of Georg postdocs. So we implemented a system, a prototype system so far. That is called Iris Plus Minus, and has been produced by extending the Iris data log engine. So what we've done was to implement the decidable fragments and especially the first-order writable fragments of data log plus minus. The two that are called linear data log plus minus and sticky data log plus minus, because this can be query answering under these languages can be reduced to rewriting. Basically, what we do is take an input query, we rewrite it, and then we execute it over a database. The engine is completely open source. There's a link on the slides. You can go to that link and download it for free. It's fully open source. What we do is to support parallel rewriting. So we do the rewriting of the queries in parallel by decomposing them into pieces that can be rewritten independently. And then we translate everything into SQL, and we execute it over a normal SQL database. We are aware of at least two other systems that implement something similar to what we have done for data log plus minus, but it is not a parallel implementation. So usually they're not capable of scaling to large ontologies. The first one is called Alaska, and it's been developed by the University of Montpellier. The other one is the systems are on slide 38. And the other one is an extension of the DLV engine done by the people in Calabria that implements a very specific fragment of data log plus minus that is called the shy fragment, and that is not first order rewritable. So in that case, they cannot fully rewrite the query, completely intentionally rewrite the query. What they do is to do forward chaining partially. And that means that if you have a very large database, this can become unfeasible. What we do is completely based on rewriting. It's fully rewritable, what we have there. So you can always go to a normal database. There's no problem. And I think here...
Thank you very much. This concludes the presentation from our part.
Okay, thank you very much. George and Giorgio. What we'd like to do now is open up discussion, a general question and answer period for the participants and the speakers. So please, in the chat room, the mechanics of this is select the hand in the lower right of the chat room to ask a query, and then we'll recognize you, and you may have to unmute. So do we have questions from the audience to any of the speakers? Please raise your hand if you have a question. Okay, I know there were some comments within the chat session previously, probably most of which were answered, but I'd like to raise the first question then. Initially, I'd address this to Harold and the use of modal operators within Greylog. Harold, did you want to respond to that?
Can you repeat the question in your own words?
Yes. I wondered how you would express a modal logic, so modal expressions with operators using Greylog.
I answered in the Skype chat, in the chat we have here, and it's a special kind of complex box. So you can find how to do that. You encapsulate the modal statement into a complex box. That means it's not asserted. So you can have, for instance, modal logic of belief. You can encapsulate what is being believed by some agent in a complex box.
I see. So it acts as a context for those beliefs.
Yeah, some of these boxes withdraw what is asserted from the top level knowledge base, so it's only local then.
I see. Good, thank you. Additional questions, comments?
So I see Konrad Bock asked, does well-founded LP fit in somewhere?
Yes, Konrad? You may have to hit star 7.
That was the entirety of the question.
Yeah, well-founded LP. So we have made an extension of Datalog Plus Minus to well-founded Datalog Plus Minus. And that's, we have two papers, namely one paper on, because given that we have existential quantifiers, we are inventing new, basically, we are inventing function terms, or if you want, Skolem constants. Now, based on whether these Skolem constants can be equal or unequal, yeah, now, whether you have a kind of unique name assumptions for them or not, yeah, we have two versions of the well-founded semantics, and we published both. So I will next week, unfortunately I can't do that, only next week, give you a survey, put in additional material with links to it.
Actually, I realized that question was really for Ben because he was discussing the feasibility.
Can you restate the question? Can you restate the question then for me? Thanks.
I was wondering where did well-founded LP fit into your description and overview of the various.
Okay, I sent an answer to the chat. LP, in the sense I was talking about, is well-founded LP. Although that overlaps in many cases, including the stratified one that Georg talked about, with the other major semantics that people sometimes work with, which is known as the stable semantics originally, nowadays known as answer set semantics. Well-founded has a number of advantages, theoretically and practically. You have a guaranteed set of conclusions. Sometimes with stable or answer set semantics, even the set of conclusions does not exist, which is not the same thing as saying it's empty. It's like you don't even know what the set of conclusions is one way to think about it. But more importantly, well-founded is polytime in the propositional or the ground case for answering inferences, doing query answering, as Georg talked about the complexity of, whereas stable semantics and answer set semantics are second level in the polynomial hierarchy, so they're kind of double exponential. So most commercial, I'm not aware of any serious commercial usage other than for certain types of limited kind of scheduling or constraint set kind of stuff of answer set semantic stuff, whereas there are a number of systems that have been using well-founded commercially for a while. There were some other questions on the chat about usages of HiLog. Amanda had a question about that. I'd like to invite her because I'm not sure I answered all her questions in the chat. I just think with one more thought on well-founded, well-founded, I think, sticks more closely to the spirit of LP, which is what philosophers originally called intuitionistic or definite. You draw your conclusions just about individual literals, and you don't try to think in terms of minimal length causal conclusions that are length more than one. And that has a lot of advantages, not just for computational complexity, but for extensibility to defeasibility and extensibility to triggering actions in the sense of making your rule systems be reactive the way that, for example, production rules and event condition action rules are and workflow systems use. So well-founded, I think, is closer to the spirit of databases and answer set semantics is sort of in between that spirit of well-founded and classical, although as an intermediate point, it has some nice features. So hopefully that answers your question, Conrad, about that. I'd like to invite Amanda to restate any questions she still has about HiLog, and I think there were some other people asking about that as well.
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So I guess my last question, I had seconded Leo's question about context and how what mechanisms there might be for using the elements that exist in HiLog that you described that looking at them that provide stuff sort of everything I would want, you know, in order to make contexts for reasoning and belief and so forth. But I'm not sure with sort of what whether there's some structure sort of defined for doing that. But that's actually in a way a sub question of my last question about HiLog, which had to do with tooling, and wondering what there is out there in terms of editors, reasoners, visualization, anything that directly supports using all those wonderful features.
Okay. Let me take the second more general question and then see if there's more that you'd like to ask. The first most basic aspect of tooling is, of course, support in the engine, so you actually do inferencing with things that have been specified in HiLog. And really, the key thing there is to have an engine that's highly capable with respect to dealing with logical functions. Now, database technology is not.
Mm-hmm.
Description logic technology is not. They both don't really deal with logical functions. Under the covers, you can view, because there's skolemization happening, the existential aspect of description logic is kind of getting into functions. And I think Georg and others who've worked on Datalog plus minus have helped illuminate that. And, there's kind of a connection to Georg's presentation there. The state-of-the-art techniques for dealing with logical functions really come out of the Prolog community and the first-order logic theorem-proving community, where you have to deal with things like unification, and in logic programs there is a set of techniques called tabling. Tabling stores the results of work on subgoals. There's also use of there's also indexing techniques such as TRIES, T-R-I-E, that are good for dealing with functional terms. And those get exercised, both the TRIES type indexing and various types of tabling techniques get exercised very heavily when working with the general case of HILOG. Now, some special cases of HILOG, where, for example, in triples in RDF, the predicate position, the property position, can be a variable, but you don't have logical functions, are used quite frequently. So you see that in Jenna and a number of other triple store engines. So what I think is interesting is HILOG is actually used pretty pervasively without the logical functions, but, you know, the kind of the special cases there. But with the logical functions, most business rules technology does not use logical functions. It's really only the stuff that comes out of the Prolog and the FOL communities that heavily deals with logical functions. Now, you also asked about knowledge acquisition and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Coherent has been commercializing some research that was done as part of the Bulk and Silk effort. We had some fairly exciting results there about how useful HILOG is in knowledge acquisition to let you represent in the logic things that look a lot closer to English or other natural language that you either start from in the authoring process or that you want to end up with in terms of presenting English, say, in explanations or presenting logic to be otherwise browsed or looked at in a way that's easier to understand. So there, HILOG gets used very heavily, and you need some specific support in the editors for you know, things like as basic as search or the larger number of kind of scope parentheses that get used in that so-called textual logic style that uses HILOG heavily. So Coherent's implementation is probably the most sophisticated in the world in that regard because it's really been pushing on the use of HILOG for the textual logic approach. But the Silk software, part of that became open source via the improvements to XSB and Flora 2 that were done. Coherent extends the Flora software. It's an Apache license. With some proprietary extensions, and has been funding continuing improvements, actually, in XSB as well. So anyway, I could go on more about it, but that's probably long enough for now.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Ellen Rector has a question. Ellen?
Thank you. As somebody who you keep mentioning description logics, and but a major function that most of us who use description logic heavily for is for organizing this assumption hierarchy of classes or unary predicates or however you're going to put do that or can interface with formalisms that can do that. Because for many of us, what we're looking for in many cases is a way we need to be able to test subsumption and between descriptions of abstract descriptions of classes, and organize them into hierarchies and test for equivalence when we get in novel descriptions. And that is a separate function from the type testing of individuals against class definitions.
Ellen, you seem to be fading in and out.
Sorry,
we can't hear you right now.
Can you hear me?
Yes, now.
Okay, I'll stay in this position. Many of these, for description logics, our concern is typically testing subsumption between classes and organizing large subsumption hierarchies in what are really very large nomenclatures and then using these within rules. what we then wish to do is use them within rules. Do any of these formalisms provide the subsumption testing or an interface to something like description logic? Some of us have been using DL safe rules and other kinds of mechanisms, but nothing that we have at the moment is entirely satisfactory.
Well, data log plus minus can do that. That's very easy to do, because if you can do query answering, you can also do subsumption. And for instance, if you want to know whether one query subsumes another, you assert one with constants and then you make the other one. So, I mean, there's a trick to transform that into query answering.
Has anybody actually demonstrated that these techniques are practical on the sorts of large ontologies that we use, which often have 100,000, half a million classes in them?
Yeah, what we have done tests for query answering, but given that subsumption translates immediately into query answering, it's not much more complex. So in my opinion, it's feasible in our system.
Dropped out somehow.
Hello?
Okay, yes, you dropped out.
I dropped out. Who dropped out? Me or?
You did,
yeah.
Yes.
So I say again, we have tested our systems with very large number of facts for query answering. Now, subsumption testing is a subtask, basically, of query answering. You can immediately translate it into query answering. And in this sense, I'm confident that subsumption testing, even though we haven't done it explicitly, is not much harder. And the polynomial time guarantees and actually relatively good answering times also hold for subsumption testing for data log plus minus.
Okay, Alan, did that help?
Yes, thank you. I think that's as much as an answer as we can get here. I may take it up further offline.
Okay, maybe one question remaining here. We're running near the end. I see Alex Skotkin has had some questions. I don't know, Alex, if you'd like to state one of these. Star 7, if you're interested in asking a question. Alex?
You can hear me, I see.
Yes, now we can.
Okay. Then my question was just to ask if you have, let's say, usual use cases for ontologies in different areas, for application areas, so we can compare all these beautiful languages in practice, and especially for repositories for this kind of application of languages. Just ontologies, for example, for pathology or biology, written or on Hylock, you know. Okay.
I have to put you back on mute again, Alex, but I assume the question is for Benjamin.
Can you restate the question? I had a lot of trouble making it out.
I think his version on in the chat is probably more intelligible than the verbal.
He has several questions there. So which one?
Alex?
My question was about the application of this language in different application areas.
Ah, okay, applications. All right, so okay, so it depends which language we're talking about. I mean, there are, I'm talking about different features. I mean, specifically with respect to HiLog, HiLog has been used without, kind of the part without logical functions where you have variables in the predicate positions has been used in a lot of applications, you know, triple stores, business rule systems, et cetera. Many of them support a bit of HiLog. However, with the logical functions, there's a long tradition in Prolog of kind of metaprogramming that does things that now have been kind of dignified in terms of HiLog. So it's kind of hard to answer the question with a lot of specifics. I mean, the parts that I've worked on, most specifically using diffusibility and so on, we've been did some applications in science and education, and now looking at finance and intelligence analysis. There also was work done in at Coherent. So the science and education was done during the Vulcan Silk effort. Finance and intel, intelligence analysis, defense stuff being done by Coherent Knowledge Systems. There's a demo up on their website, for example, about financial regulation. There's work in legal RuleML that is using rule IDs and starting to get into HiLog. There's work done a number of years ago as part of the Semantic Web Services framework on use of HiLog for a number of scenarios in e-commerce and services integration or services, other things around kind of sophisticated services, electronic services infrastructure. So, I mean, I think the short answer is it's been used in a variety of ways, but the big limiting factors have, you know, as Amanda was asking about, been the tooling, because you can say, okay, here's some scenarios for using it where it would be useful, but the commercial engines don't support logical functions well. So I'll put more in the chat about the state of the tools, kind of a written version of my answer to Amanda. But I would say as far as sort of maturity of applications, the ones using logical functions, mostly not that mature. So I'll leave it there.
If there are no more questions or comments, I'd like to thank the speakers for their perspectives. Very, very interesting. And a thank you to the audience for their participation and questions. This was an excellent session. And please follow on with the additional pointers the speakers have provided. And if you have offline questions, please address those to the speakers. And again, we'll have another session. Peter just typed in the chat session for ontology-based standards. That'll be on the 7th of November. And then in this series, our next occasion is November 21st, where we'll have the second session related to this. Again, thanks, everyone, for participating. And goodbye.